way to do this. Let me show you a better way. You don't have to be another face in the crowd. Well, hi folks, and welcome to episode 3849, and we are live. We are going to have an interesting discussion today with Daniel Hassley. If I said his name right, he'll correct me if I didn't on his last name when I bring him on in just a minute. But we're going to be talking about permaculture, ecological design, and homestead design, but from the lens of what does that look like prior to, during, and after societal collapse? And I've actually named today's show Permaculture for the Long Emergency. The Long Emergency is somebody else's terminology. It's been around a while. I think that's an author that wrote a book that talked about the Long Emergency, but I think it's fitting for today. And I'm going to be interested to see what Daniel has to say about it, because I have over time watching this space, been in this space, you know, full time as a professional, 18 years. And at one time, I thought we would have like this train wreck, like overnight, everything seems okay, at least to the people not paying attention. And then it's just, you know, dissolved in a couple weeks or something like that. A TV type catastrophe. And over the years, I've changed my view on that. I see us more as like, when's the collapse happening? You're in the black hole. You're being turned into a long string right now. It's just so slow and so much over time that it's wearing things down that people are actually adapting to it as their life downgrades. And I think this is why you hear more shouting about it from the younger generation than you do for the older generation. We've been watching it fall apart. We've been adapting to it. And we were established enough in our lives that as that occurred, we were able to adapt. And each generation coming up finds it more and more difficult to enter so that they can adapt. And that's kind of a different way of looking at it. But I think that's what we're involved with right now. I've had C.J. Kilmer on a few times, and we've talked about it from the concept of just from America, the end of empire. And a lot of people got upset when we used that term empire. America's not an empire. What the hell else do you call it? When you have a military presence in over, you know, like 80 countries, and you have a military presence literally in every corner of the world, when you have your fingers in every economic pie, when you decide which people take over countries are okay with you and which ones aren't, and you get rid of sometimes people just because you don't want them there, what do you call that other than an empire? And I think one thing that is consistent about empires, because there's not a lot of consistency about what an empire exactly looks like, what its form of government, how quickly it rises, whatever. But one thing is always consistent. Eventually, they always come to an end. I think that's what we're looking at right now. I'll be really interested to hear what Daniel has to say about that. Before I bring him on, though, let's go ahead and hear from our sponsors of the day. Sponsor of the day number one today is John Pugliano. John is an amazing investment manager. He also runs a podcast called, you bet, yes, it's the Wealth Steadying Podcast, where he talks about what he's doing with his money and his clients' money on a relatively like a weekly basis. It's a great podcast. It only lasts about 10 to 15 minutes per episode, one episode a week on average, so it's really easy to keep up with. Get on by wealthsteading.com. Learn about the podcast. Learn about John. Subscribe in any of the common podcast players. Again, the Wealth Steadying Podcast from John Pugliano. Next of today, it is kind of fun for me that, you know, this show's grown into a point where, like, I have two sponsors today, and both of the people that are running the companies that are sponsors are personal friends. John's been a friend of myself and Dorothy and our family since 2010. Joel Riles, I first interviewed with K9 Academy about 12 years ago. But I would say we kind of became really close friends, and he and his wife, Wendy, and I and my wife, Dorothy, became really close friends about 6-7 years ago. And here he is as a sponsor. What canineacademy.us is where you can learn to discover your dog's superpower and unleash yourself as a trainer of your dog, making sure that your dog is actually an obedient member and good citizen of the household. Training dogs isn't hard, but it is difficult. Does that make sense? What I mean by that is the things that you need to do are really simple, but it's difficult to actually do them because we love our dogs and we want them to just be a dog and we don't want to be too tough on them or whatever. But the beautiful thing about training a dog properly and obeying the three C's, which is create the condition for potential failure, control the condition so the failure is not catastrophic, and correct the failure immediately. If you do that, then you actually have a much better relationship with your dog long term. I know that Joel's method of training and mine are similar, but the things I've learned from him made even my very well-behaved dogs much better citizens of the home. Check him out. He's got all these courses you can take online, and you can start with the problem-solving library, which is like a free short course where you can get a feel for whether or not you like what Joel does as a trainer. Again, K9Academy.us. And with that, I want to bring our special guest on, Daniel Housley. Did I say that right, Daniel? I usually remember to ask a guest during our little talk before we go live, and I didn't. So I'm sorry if I got it wrong.
No problem. Halsey.
Halsey. Okay, close.
Halsey Hall or Admiral Halsey, stuff like that.
All right, I got close. Let's start off with kind of your backstory. You know, what got you interested in ecological design and homestead design? And go back before you were, because I find that most people come on the show to talk about something deep like this. They weren't sitting in study hall in school going, I want to grow up and do ecological design, right? They went off and did some other thing, and they eventually found their way through some, you know, curvy, wonky path to this place.
That is true with me. So I've been self-employed all my life since my early 20s. I was a food photographer, package designer for about 25 years. Anyway, around 95, I got sepsis, toxic shock. Went in the hospital, lost about 25 pounds. It was, all my friends and neighbors were visiting me in the hospital. It was not a good sign. Saying hello. And survived through that. And one of the nurses said, you need to talk to Dr. Kevin Wand, who was a homeopath, osteopath doctor. I met with him. Luckily, he was in my insurance network. And he just basically said, you got to learn what food is, first of all, because, you know, in order to save your life, they kind of messed up your gut. They got rid of all your bugs. So we got to rebuild your stomach, your digestive system, all that. And he sent me to the natural food store that was in the area, started buying good food, learned what food actually was, what I should be eating. Became very much appreciative of the taste, the flavor, and all of that. It was a little more expensive, of course. But I saw a permaculture magazine in the magazine rack. And that was in, you know, they had good artwork. This is like 99, 97, something like that. And picked that out, started reading all about the British doing their allotments and growing. You know, a lot of it was that. And then it started to be more in the U.S. And then I think it was around early 2000s sometime, I ran into my first permaculture person at a show, and Paula Westmoreland, who became my mentor along with a number of other people. And that's when I started learning about permaculture. And that's when I started growing potatoes and peppers, that kind of thing, and learning what food actually was supposed to taste like. You know, if you've ever grown your own potatoes and tomatoes, it's like, oh, this is what it's supposed to be.
Yeah. What's right? That funny taste? We call that flavor.
Exactly. And it's kind of sad now. I can't buy anything in the store, you know, tomatoes, especially things like that. I got to wait. And we got them going now here. But anyway, that got me into permaculture. And mid 2000s, I was learning a lot, got my PDC, all that kind of stuff. Right. But I was big into Adobe Illustrator, doing package design. And in 2003, I got what became available to me was a small hobby farm. So I had a place to grow stuff, things like that. We had a lot of classes there through what was called PRI Cold Climate at the time. And I learned all about permaculture, how it worked. I was just amazed, like everybody else in the beginning, about mushrooms, what? Worms do what? You know, yeah. Soil, yeah. Mycelium, you know, that kind of stuff. It's like, it was amazing. And then at that point, I started to use my skills as a designer to design my own place. And in 2008, remember that whole subprime economics collapse sort of system? My industry took a big hit with that. And I went back to school, learned landscape design, but I put a flip on that and I got a master's in horticulture in ecological design. I wanted to take all those processes and turn them into what permaculture was. And that's kind of how I got into it, very deeply. And over the years, Jeff Lawton visited my farm twice, did some workshops, did some videos with him, all of that. And that's what kind of carried me forward.
Cool. I know that you actually come at this from looking at the potential for collapse and an adaptation to collapse. So what influence did prepping have on your work, and what do you feel about it now as to working into design concepts of preparedness? Because one of the things that really attracted me to permaculture in the first place is you could not give a rip about preparedness, but if you actually follow the principles, you're preparing.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, they like literally, like the first time I ever interviewed, you mentioned Jeff. First time I ever interviewed Jeff, I'm like, I think this guy's more of a prepper than me. Right. Like, but he wasn't even thinking of it that way.
Right.
And you mentioned like the subprime crisis, like literally that launched my show. I started back in 2008 and I was like, yeah, it literally, like some of my first episodes, first couple of months, I was telling people, get out of the stock market, get out of the stock market, get out of the stock market. And you know what happened that fall. Right. Like the reality check came. And like you said, it just knocks sectors in the ass. And I think one of the problems people have is they forget pain really fast.
Yes.
And I don't think any of those things that we think are behind us are behind us. Like I said, in the buildup to this, I think we're in this kind of this long, slow spiral. You know, if you've ever seen like the science fiction thing where like the ship is like, there's somebody in the black hole and they see it, but it's actually them and it's a reflection or something. Like, I think that's kind of where we're at with this. So how does prepping fit into all this for you?
Right. Well, when I started getting into that was because some of my clients for doing homestead design were preppers. Right. And that was really my first big exposure to it. And one of them was a hedge fund manager. Right. That had bought this farm on the Canadian border and wanted to help because that was going to be his bug out place for his family and everything, which was great. Brilliant guy. Right. And that's one of the first things I learned right away is all this stuff you see on TV and the media, preppers are these crazy people out there with camo and guns and, you know, not true. These people are really smart. They know what's going on. They're paying attention. And for the most part, even though a lot of them see it as kind of, Mike, say it, it's like a serious hobby. It's like permaculture. Whatever you're doing, it doesn't hurt. Right. You're preparing. And even if nothing happens, you still have a better life, you know, vegetable wise, all those kinds of things. And you feel better about it, too. But the thing that it would have brought to the fore for me was the fact that if there was a collapse, if something comes happen, okay, it can't just be a bunch of pretty pictures and a lot of drawings that, you know, oh, it's going to be so poetic and we're going to have, you know, singing circles and stuff like that. Everything has to grow. Everything has to work. So basically put permaculture under pressure and it actually has to work. And in that sense, it's like, okay, what is the most efficient, practical way to start growing food? What kind of systems do we need to have? And then back to the whole thing, even with Mollison, was redundant systems, failure points, all that kind of stuff. Things need to have multiple functions in order to support the system, all that kind of stuff. And it really came to me as the systems have to be resilient, especially when they're under pressure. And all these resources that we're using right now, and I used to use this as an example all the time, you break a shovel handle, great, go to Home Depot, you get another one. Not going to happen, right? You have to learn how to make things and how to use things just like people did back in the 20s and the 30s, right? You're going to have to go find a piece of ironwood and make a new one. And there's your afternoon, you know, calories, all those things. So it really brought me into this, to the vision that this is serious now. This is not just a play thing. This has to work for people because it's about survival and thriving.
Well, and there's a lot of permaculture that you can just look at and go, there's a preparedness angle there. If we look at something like the fact that we design more in an interactive mesh pattern than a linear pattern, that's a preparedness principle because we avoid single points of failure when we design that way. I think some of them gets like glossed over, though, that is foundational principles, and people do it, talk about it, but they don't realize how much of a preparedness aspect it is. One of those would be something like zone-based design. By moving the most intensive design that feeds the people that live on the land into zones 1 and 2, and mostly into zone 1, we minimize effort, distance traveled, etc. And so, yes, we take better care of the garden if it's in zone 1, if we can see it out the back window. We're less likely to show up a week later and it be full of weeds or something because we took care of it. But the other side of it is if we have injury, if we have a condensed timeline, if we have anything going on where we need to be more efficient and quicker in our acquisition of our food so that we can eat, then all of the things that we need day to day to survive are close to us. And on a big property where maybe you have a zone three, you know, that would be on a larger true farm, like, you know, your grazing pastures or your cornfield or something like that. Those are things, if you think about the traditional like work arc of a farmer, there's a whole lot of, I mean, there's equipment. I don't want to poo-poo any farmers, but you're not actually doing much to grow shit in the middle of that kind of operation. The corn gets in the ground. It's a lot of work. It starts to come up. It gets up over the weed line. You sit back and wait 80 days, and then you're busy again with harvest. So by moving that out to your zone three, not only just work better, but that's generally the kind of thing. If I have to wait an extra day to do it, I'm going to be all right. Right. But if I need to go out and gather what we need to eat tonight, I got to do it whether I'm limping or not, if that makes sense.
Exactly. Exactly. And to your point, one of the great references I have is my father grew up on a dairy farm. He was born in the 20s. And talk about, I mean, they had horse-drawn carriages, all that kind of stuff. But when you consider what preppers need to have, or people who are subsistence living on a homestead, that's what it was back then. You know, they also had, they had dairy cows, and they had all of that, and people are working on the farm. But they also had a garden, about 2.5 acres, that my great aunt, who took care of my dad, did all the cooking, everything from scratch. Can you imagine the life that they had at that time? If there was a collapse or something like that for us, it would just basically be what their life was. They would look at us and go, yeah, so? You know, it's like, you know, buck up, man. That's what life is all about, you know, canning. And once, I have one memory of that too, is going in their basement. Their basement was like a production facility where they could get everything they needed, canned, dried, whatever, put, you know, in the basement, and they were ready for winter. So that's a really amazing image in my head for that.
Yeah. Yeah. Same. I mean, I grew up with grandparents that were first generation immigrants from Ukraine. As children, they kind of met through local community, like literally where I grew up. Everybody on there was two roads, road one and road two. And I'm not making that shit up. RD1 and RD2. And literally everybody on RD1 and half the people on RD2 were from the same kind of village area of Ukraine. Right. And, you know, I've talked about this on the show before. We grew a garden because we needed food. We didn't do it because it was trendy or whatever. Like, it was literally part of the budget for food. We can't, give my grandma credit. She canned everything. If it could go in a can, it went in a can, you know. We hunted for meat that was part of our annual budget for food. Like, that was how we grew up. And, yeah, I mean, we did have electricity. But other than – I would say that was kind of the one thing we actually had that we really – like, we would have missed it if it went away. Because everything else would have just kept going. We had a coal stove. Right. I mean, heat, there's the heat, like you use the outside, you know, stove. It was an older coal stove during the summer because it would kill us in the house. I mean, it was just too hot. Right. Like, so we didn't even think about preparedness. It just was a thing. And I think that there's a few of us that are old enough that we live on that overlap. We had one foot on both sides of the world for a while. Exactly. And so we know what it looked like before, but I mean, after us, well, the way things are going, it may not be after us, but right now, if it holds together long enough, after us, there won't be, you know, in another 30 years, there won't be many people that ever even saw the prior world. It might be the one we're heading back to. Things tend to be circular in society.
You know, that really is true. And I talk about that in some of my classes about I had my great aunt, my dad, exposed dairy farm, gardening, all of that. When I grew up, there was none of that. One generation done, gone. I have no idea how anything was done, how you deal with cows, how you grow food, any of that. I grew carrots once as a kid just because, and you know, and that's all that happened. Everything else was out of the basement in the stores, right? So anyway, it's like that, right? And we can hopefully have a lot of people that will still have the knowledge, and there are enough of us doing that. But the other thing to remember is the marginalized society, you might say, the marginalized people are still living that way. Look at the Appalachian Mountains. Look at people living on, you know, reservations, places like that. The guys that are out, like they have out in Wisconsin, there's people just out there living their life. Northern Minnesota, every state probably has those people, right? They're just getting by, and they're not depending on resources that the populace is using. So if anything happens, they'll notice, but their life is probably less affected because they're less dependent on it.
Yeah. Yeah, I have to say, you know, honestly, for me, that's a lot of how, like, the whole COVID years felt. Like, I noticed, I had to, it was my job to, I had tons of people in this audience freaking out and asking me, but my life did not change at all. Other than I guess I went to a few left restaurants for a while until Greg Abbott pulled his head out of his ass. Right. But like people are, you know, they're emailing me, what do we do? I'm like, I've been telling you for 16 years what to do.
Like, I was really lucky.
Do now you have a problem. Now you have supply shortages. Now, like, mm-hmm. I had people emailing me, like, where can I get grain? I'm like, do you really need to get a 50-pound sack of wheat right now? But if you do, go to the feed store, right? Stop trying to buy from Harvey, but go to the feed store. Go to homebrew store. They have all the freaking wheat and barley you want, man. Go nuts, you know? And there is a weird thing about being prepared when things go wrong. It's not that you are happy that it went wrong. It's that if nobody really told you, you might not even really notice. You'd be like, well, that's weird. What are those people doing that over there for? But something as big as that was, we all knew because they pumped it into our lives, right?
Yeah.
But I also just wonder, like, is there any of that actually happening to people right now because they still have the modern communities to depend on? They don't like I was talking about this long emergency concept. They don't really – I don't think people really understand what's happening right now. And I think there's – unfortunately, a lot of people like our age bracket and a little bit older – that, like, I am tough on young people. Like, I don't want to hear you, bitch. I want you to get up. I want you to work. I want you to plan your life. But I'm also not stupid where I'm going to be like, oh, it's just as easy for you as it was for us. No, it's not. And it keeps getting worse. And I'm just wondering if we get to a point where maybe it's the, you know, the generation one rung above us that's kind of aging out and going on to the other side now. As those people go, I think then maybe everybody will look around collectively and go, holy shit, look how bad it is.
Right, right. And I think that's part of it, too. You know, when you talk about the phases, Clown Week, a lot of people think we're in Clown Week, right?
Yeah.
A lot of people think that it's coming. And I've kind of felt that myself in situations, and especially since I've been studying it now, really, for like the last 8 months, seriously, doing that. And the book, The Earth Abides, written in 1951, if you've ever read that, amazing book about after an EMP. Imagine that in 1951. But it was all the older generation remembering things, how they were done, having to go back to that. Or even in Cuba, when they had the, you know, they lost all their diesel fuel back and with the power of community, when that was out there as a movie, you know, they had to get all the old skills, all the things that farmers knew, people that had cattle, people that had donkeys, people that had oxen, and had to get them going again, right? But like you're saying, if there is that gap and all that is missing, there won't be that resource, right?
Yeah.
It'll be gone. It's all about timing and something like that.
So you also have been going to Colorado and working with something called the Observer Ranch Community. You want to talk about that a little bit? What brought you to that?
Sure. So I was for the last four winters, three of the last four winters, I was down in Alabama working on a project, which was great. Coming from Minnesota. Yeah. And then winter before this one, I was in Fargo for the first time for a whole winter working on another project. And that actually ended in February. And I'm in touch with Mike Hagwood all the time. We're good buds. We're design places together, things like that. And he was down working at the Observer Ranch, helping them get it started with the RV park and the community down there. And so I'm in Fargo trying to think, where's my next place? I gave him a call. And he said, hey, come down here. Help us with what's going on down here. And Colorado is amazing. Having tried, you know, across the country. And by the way, I've been in my RV now for 5 years. I'm not right now. Traveling the country doing design work. And so I was up there and say, yeah, this is great. Went to Colorado a year ago, March. Got together with Mark. What's going down there? Learned all about the suspicious observers, Ben Davidson's group. All the information and all the different calamities and things that they're expecting to come along over the world. And so I went down to the ranch. I parked my RV there for about 6 months working with them. And then actually I'm up north of Denver now. Met a nice lady. What can I say? and working on finding some land somewhere else in Colorado. But anyway, got there, worked with him. And what's amazing to me, every place I go, everywhere in the world I've been, I always say I have to come in absolutely clueless. I know nothing. No presuppositions, no assumptions about anything, right? And what I started to learn about Colorado and the 5% humidity, you know, at 5,000 feet to 8,000 to 9,000 feet, the UV that was here, the sunlight, all of that, and this strange weather that they had. I mean, as an example, we got 6 inches of snow 2 weeks ago. Then it was 90 degrees and sun, and we're covering everything up. Then we went down to 35 degrees last night. I mean, it's just this place. It's just a roller coaster, right, Colorado. But that's what I love about it, because it's systems-oriented.
Yeah.
And kind of like you're saying, is that, and all your systems have to work really well because you don't have time to screw around, you know, with any of that. And
it's a weird climate. I mean, and it's not just Colorado. It's like all the way up into Montana. I remember we did a project for a food forest for the city of Helena. Mm-hmm. And I've got all these people that are locals that are part of this class, and we're out there talking, and we're standing out in this park where we're doing the design work for, and they keep talking about how hot it is. And I'm like, what the hell are y'all talking about? And they thought I was just jacking with them because I'm, you know, I'm from Texas and it gets hotter here. Well, no shit, it gets hotter. And they're like, it's like 98 degrees. I'm like, no, it's not. You pull your phone, you look, you go, holy crap, it is. It's so dry, you don't feel the heat. So it's drying your ass out. You know, exactly. And then I remember being in Colorado even years before that, and it was like 45 degrees out. I'm dressed like I am now, standing in the sun, and I'm totally comfortable because of the UV radiation. You walk into a shadow, you're like, holy shit, what happened? You run right back to the sun. It is one of the more unique and extremely varied climates. Think about the differential, not just in, like you said, like one day it's 95 and next there's 35 and snow dusting, right? But the microclimate variation is extreme in those climates. So, like you said, everything you do, like, oh, this seems like a great place, except it gets in a shadow for 6 hours a day. And, you literally get a freeze when it's not freezing at some point.
It was interesting, too, because I'm down at the ranch. I get parked there, get everything set up, and all of a sudden we get like 50-mile-an-hour winds. And I actually was in a tornado a couple of years ago. It was about 300 feet from my rig. Lots of stories there. But anyway, I wasn't in the rig at the time. I was in a shelter. But anyway, 50-mile-an-hour winds just howling through. Everything's rocking. The RV is rocking a little bit, although it's really strong. I actually have ground anchors for it now after the tornado to anchor the thing to the ground. And then Mike is telling me, we have a saying here. When we get 2 inches of rain, that's because the drops are 2 inches apart on the ground, not because we actually got 2 inches of rain. That's what we measure.
Yeah.
And you'd see the storms coming, and then it would be like it would just part and go around the ranch because there's mountains and hills over here and mountains and hills over there. So like you're saying, the microclimates are incredible. Just south of the ranch is a place called the Wet Mountains. And all you do is sit there all week and watch the clouds go through and the fog go through, and it rains over there. And where we are is absolutely dry. So the microclimates are like half a mile apart, you know, whereas like I'm from Minnesota, they're, you know, 40 or 50 miles, it might be different somewhere else, but the huge prairie storms come by, they hit everybody. But down here, like you say, very specific, and that we have a workshop coming up this weekend, and we're talking about being site specific. You have to understand where you are in order to really be successful. You know, you can't be general and not reading it just from some YouTube video from somewhere else. And the microclimates, and then watching the weather and being ready for all these extreme changes. On the other hand, I have to say, because of those diurnal changes, it's a very temperate climate. You know, I mean, all winter, it might have got down to 10 degrees for a couple of days. Other than that, it's usually 50 during the day. So it's kind of a human-centric comfortable, but it's very difficult to grow anything.
Mm. Can you tell us a little more specifically about Observer Ranch and exactly what that is?
Sure. So Ben Davidson started doing his podcasts and his YouTubes years ago. He talks about space weather, and he talks about the sun and sunspots and coronal mass ejections and all those things and what's going to happen to the planet from all these different things. He's got some really, really good science, and he does 5:30 every morning on YouTube. He does his podcast. You know, mm-hmm. it's pretty amazing. And he just has science, and then he has his interpretation of what's going to happen. Well, after a while, people were asking, so what are we supposed to do? So his response was, well, let's find the safest place to be if the worst thing happens. And for them, it was basically above 4,000 feet, something like that, somewhere away from the oceans. And it turned out to be near Penrose, Colorado, where they picked this land, right? Now, and so a number of people have actually been moving out to Colorado to join the community that's out there. They have lots for lease. They have like 99-year leases. And they have a big RV park where I park, and a lot of people come and park the RVs. Very nice place. They did not spare anything on making sure that it was comfortable for people, attractive, well-designed resources in this. And then in the underneath of that, of all that, is the foundation of long-lasting preparedness and resilience for anything that might happen for that. And that's why I'm there with Mike. We're trying to build the systems and help people understand where they are and what's going to happen. And there were actually people out here, and I met one of them. They're only about 20 miles away. They've actually moved out here for the same reason. Geographically, it's a very safe place relative to any kind of cataclysmic earth meteor, depending where it hits, of course, global shifts in crust, earthquakes, things like that. It's actually a very safe place. So the Observer Ranch was located here for that. And he does his workshops. They have weekend workshops every weekend. Now he's traveling the country doing his space weather presentations. So he built this ranch for people to come and learn more about resilience, being a prepper, and then also survival of any of these calamities that might happen.
Okay. What inspired you to start writing this new book about the phases of collapse in preparation for long-term thriving as opposed to survival? So that's kind of, you're taking, honestly, a page out of our book here that, like, build your life to be phenomenal no matter what happens, yeah, rather than prepare to go live in a bunker.
That's right. That's right. And that's what I used to say about permaculture, too, was, you know, if you love being outside and you like growing things and all that, there is no downside to this kind of work, right? It's just your life is better all around. If nothing happens, it doesn't matter. But you've already saved yourself thousands of dollars, and especially groceries. Can you imagine right now? We had those gardens going. I mean, the average garden used to be about $6,000 worth of produce. And that was about 10 years ago that people were getting that. By the way, tax-free, so it's actually probably $9,000 now. But anyway, so the book kind of started from working with Ben and working with Mike and Barb down there, meeting all the people and what they're talking about, and learned a lot about tools. You know, there's a lot of the preppers and a lot of things focus on drama, all the drama that's involved with, oh, we need weapons, we need guns, we need this, I need a bunker, I got to do all these kinds of things. And it dawned on me, because I work with intentional communities a lot and worked with large groups, that, you know, there's another story that needs to be told. And it's not just, yes, you have your cans of food and you have your bunker maybe, but we're really looking at, let's just say, year two, year three. It's great if you get and survive all through that, but you really have to understand is, like you said, the long emergency, you've got a long way in drawdown. So you have clown week, hell week, and then the drawdown. Okay, what are you going to do after all that? The canned food's gone. Everything's used up. You really need to prepare your place for survival and thriving afterwards. But in the sense, if you're going to do it as a community, which I kind of is what I'm writing about here, you need to have a group, your tribe, your posse, whatever you want to call it. And you need to have some rules and understanding of how it's going to work. And it's not about things you own. It's not about owning land. It's about systems. And it's about community. And it's about understanding rules and how things are going to work. And so the drawdown book that I'm writing, which was inspired by the Observer Ranch, with a lot of discussions with Mike, talking about all these different things, and also learning from the intentional communities why a lot of them failed or never even started, was mostly that they may have had a similar belief system, but their lifestyles were so different they could never make them work, right? Everybody has to agree on a lifestyle. You can have whatever belief system you have you want on that. That's how you want to run your life. But the lifestyle of we're living as a community, the amount of work it's going to be, now we're going back to that 1920s and 30s and 40s farm. Everybody understood. Everybody's up at 6 or 5 or 4. Got to get things going because that's how you thrive and that's how you get going. So the book is really based on all of those items in there, the table of contents. And I even have created basically a worksheet drawdown assessment with all the questions that are actually tied to pages in the book. So you can actually answer these questions. And if you're not ready for these things, you've probably seen these things too. You know, do you have this? Do you have this? Do you have that? But also, do you have the understanding of what it takes when somebody comes knocking on your door? You know, what happens if there's a fire? And especially around here, fire. I grew up with tornadoes. I did not grow up with fires being a weekly thing. You know, I mean, it's like in the distance everywhere. And it's just an example. Last winter, they had 115 mile an hour winds in Boulder, Colorado. No snow, 5% humidity. Right. They shut the power off to three counties for 5 days.
Yeah.
What would tell you more that something's coming other than that?
Yeah. Yeah. And they kind of, in that situation, people get pissed, but you kind of have to. Like, if you shut it down, when it's over, you can turn it back on. If you let that kind of crap go on in a storm like that, with wind like that, you're going to have catastrophic damage to that portion of the electrical grid. You're probably still going to have some lines down and stuff like that anyway, but you don't cause the upsystem shock that comes from that. I have a good friend of the community here, Patrick, and he was a lineman for a lot of years. And he's like, when your lights go off for a second and they come back on and that's it, you're probably good. He's like, when they do it two times in a row, it's fixing to go off and it's going to stay off for a day.
Yeah.
And it has to do with the fail safes built into the system. And that's basically that branch slammed the hell out of that line and it quit. Exactly. So like a breaker tripped on and off and went, okay, yeah, you're good. But when it trips that second time, it's off and it causes, like, it can cause this cascade effect, which is much more advanced version is what happened here in Texas 4 years ago when we had the big freeze, you know, and the power was off for, I think mine was off for 6 days. Some people were up to 11, 12 days. And, you know, it's Texas, but sometimes in winter, it's actually cold here.
Yeah.
And we went half of that time without ever seeing a double digit temperature.
Really?
I mean, for highs,
right?
Our highs were like 8-9 degrees for half of a 10 day outage.
Right.
And this place is not resilient to cold. We are not built for that. There's a 68,000 acre lake about 10 minutes from my house. It was so frozen, people walked on it. Right. And the only guy that had ever remembered it actually freezing before is the dude that's like 90 that lives behind my house. So he made it like it happened all the time. Oh, yeah, that lake freezes. Well, when's the last time, Ben? So that would have been like 1952. It's like, you do realize we're in the 2020s, bro, right? Like, things like that happen and they expose a weakness. So then you have to ask yourself, well, what happens when that becomes the normative versus the exception? Because people do not handle it well.
It's people expect things to come back on, right? And that's the delay. And that's another part of the topics is, when do you move? When do you act? How long do you wait for those things, right? And if it comes on every time and all of a sudden it's off for 3 days, well, certainly it's going to come on, you know. But the same thing happens if you have a catastrophic power outage. What may also go off is the natural gas, because there are switches and things like that that are running bad. And especially during cold climates, let's say, and one of our examples always was like in Minnesota, where I'm from, and I've been writing fiction about the same scenarios for years, just for my own. It helps me write other things when I write stories. Mm. So Minnesota, if the natural gas went off for 3 days and it's in the middle of winter, pipes are frozen. All the house pipes are frozen, right? There's no heat. The house then thaws. The pipes burst. Now it's not even, you can't even be in the house, right? So the cascading effects of any of those utilities failing is huge.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing, of course, is to have redundant systems so you don't have to rely on that. And, you know, a little plug for RVs, which I've been studying a long time, is my kind of mobility and my kind of RV, my RV bug out as a lifestyle is, I have multiple systems for heat, multiple systems for water, multiple systems for all sorts of things because you have to. Because I'm in a cardboard box on a Ford 550 Super Duty. That's all there is. Anything is catastrophic in this little thing. But the same thing applies to every kind of system in these houses that are dependent on outside resources. And the more you're dependent on outside resources, you are a victim if any one of those things go down.
Yeah. And your comment on the water, the reason I reacted the way I did, that's exactly what happened here during that event we just talked about. And we did have some people in Texas during that event that lost natural gas. Mm-hmm. And not everybody, but there were certain areas. So that just made everything worse. But when you talk about the pipes freezing and then thawing, yeah, I mean, my niece was in college at the time in a dorm down at Texas Tech. And on like the fourth floor in a building that was like an 8-story building. So not only did the water come back on, but the water upstairs came back on and leaked. And some of these places like had literally catastrophic flood damage, even though there was no real flood. It was the same net effect from water literally seeping between floors. And right. And this was incredibly widespread. Like even in my neighborhood, it didn't affect us. I got backup heat. I got backup electricity. I was watching a football game while it was going on. Like, I mean, it didn't bother me, but it was, I'll put it this way. I went to, after we'd finally kind of get out, I went down to a local store that had gotten power back and was up. It was like a QT, like one of the mega convenience stores. And I was literally watching people hold their hands over the gross rollers that roll the hot dogs and shit in one of those places and warming their hands over that. People were crowding into any place that was open because they had heat. And right. And that was what, a half a week in yep. Texas? Half a week is all yep. it takes.
What do they say? 9 meals, right?
Yeah.
Nine meals and things fall apart.
Yeah. That's probably about right. 3 days, 9 meals. Can you maybe talk about some of the, in particular, chapters and topics in your book? And the different subjects you cover, because it might be interesting to our listeners to kind of get a look at what your work you're doing really with that.
Sure. Yeah, for sure. So one of the major things we talk about in the book, first of all, I start out with, you know, what is it that we're looking at and the phases and how we, you know, name them. And I also start talking about, as I talked a little bit earlier, and it says right at the beginning of the book, this may be very boring for you. Hmm. This may be very hard for you to read, but as you get through it, it will start making sense because you have to think of these things ahead of time. This is how you make decisions of things coming along. And one of the things right away is what's one of those most important things, like especially down here in a semi-arid climate, I should say, is water. And because the book is written about drawdown, it's kind of around this area, I focus on those things. And water is a governing capital. You have to have it, right? And when you use it, it's gone. It's not an asset that appreciates, right? It's not a tree that keeps coming and keeps bringing fruit. Once the water comes through and it's gone, and water is a governing capital. So I start talking about capital and assets and expendables and things like that. These are the things that help you make decisions. And so you have to decide what your doctrine is before the crisis happens. How are you going to treat water? Are you going to just use it as you always have? Or are you going to figure out ways to save it, reuse it, use it again, which is all back to permaculture principles again, right? And working that way. What are going to be your operating rules? Now, in a lot of communities, let's just say if you're an Amish community, they already have rules. They already have their governance, right? And they're already kind of on their own doing things. Again, talking about some organization that's already got things going, like it or not. But they already have their belief systems, their doctrines that basically help them make those decisions. They also have authorities, you know, authority in those relationships that help them make decisions too. So you got to have operating rules, and we talk about that. And then also, I write a little bit about mobile resilience because during, say, Clown Week and Hell Week, for us individuals, you're going to have to decide, when do I leave? When do I move? What do I take with me? And where am I going to go? And those are big decisions, all of which need to also have redundant answers, you know? I could go here or I could go there, but you have to also be able to understand what am I watching in order to decide when I'm going to go and why I'm going to leave and what timing is. And a lot of times survival is based on timing, not on stuff. It's like, when did you have a chance to leave and when did you miss it? If you wait too long, the roads are going to be clogged, everything's going to be going and you're going to be stuck, right? Or there's not going to be fuel, things like that, even if we have all the vehicles we need to do that. So the different chapters are similar in that way. We're talking about mindsets for survival, conditions of belonging. Even if you have these communities and if you're going to have people coming in or you're building these, it's conditional consent to be there. You can be there, but there are rules you have to follow. And that's the tough order of it. It's not just letting anybody or anybody come in that wants to. They have to be valuable. And that's a tough decision to make. What is your belief system when people come knocking at the door and they're hungry or they're cold and you have limited resources? It's tough. And we talk about making those decisions too. Leadership, all of that. And also, like, during Hell Week, there's an authority that has to be the leader that helps you make decisions, and you just do what you're told. It's like having a general, right? During a battle, you follow the orders, you follow the authority, because there is no time to waste, and you've trusted this person to make good decisions. After the battle is over, during drawdown, that person steps down, and now you're back to more of an organizational person that's kind of helping you get organized and kind of making the other long-term decisions. So we're talking about the progress of a community and everything it takes, even what kids, how are you going to handle children? How are you going to handle dogs and cats and pets and things like that? You have to have an understanding and rule for all those things. And that's what we talk about. Firewood, and you brought up coal, which is really good. Mike talks about that a lot too, because there is coal in this area, and the people I knew in North Dakota had it too. And it's like, firewood is great, but if you have access to coal, that's amazing.
Yeah, yeah, and it's an extremely dense form of energy. It's, you know, I know there's a lot of people that have problems with it being dirty and whatever. And from a mining standpoint, I grew up in coal country where strip mining was a thing for 80 years. I don't approve of it either, but it's also a very dense source of energy. And yeah, if it's around and you need energy, it's something, you know, and if we were living the way that we're talking about, you wouldn't need very much of it per household, honestly.
No, for sure. And we talk about that. So I talk about this in the book too, of your sources of energy, whether it's solar, right? There's solar heat and solar power, which isn't talked about a lot, but there's a way to use the sun to heat your house also. And there's wood. But when do you use them, and how do you prioritize that? Because for a lot of people, like here even, there's not a lot of wood. There's not, like, I had an oak forest in Minnesota on my farm before I sold it in 21. All the oak firewood I needed. I had a 28-inch firebox, and my firebox furnace was great. Heat the whole place all winter, not a problem, right? But if that's scarce, you reserve certain things for certain uses. So in a sense, coal is used for heat. In the middle of winter, that's when you use the coal, because it's so dense and so much heat comes out of it. The rest of the time, you're using wood for cooking because it's controllable. And also, like you're saying, it's just the mess that coal provides, but it is a very good resource for energy for heat.
Yeah, definitely. You've had some people kind of peer review the work you're doing. What kind of response have you gotten from that?
Having some really good discussions with people, a great response. A lot of it was more or less thought provoking, but it wasn't any, it's funny because it's not discussions about our favorite this or I want to do it this way. It was like deep thinking, like, well, that's true. This is a problem. How are we going to do that? It's like when you have kids, how are kids going to be managed? Who's responsible for them? How do you keep them safe? How do you make sure enough people are getting enough food? All those things, which are policy decisions. You know, they're like doctrine and belief decisions. They're not about, you know, how we're going to get enough or how it's going to work. It's really that kind of response we've had in our discussions. And one of the areas I talk about, the problem with making change is one of the later chapters. All those things that keep us from actually making change, even though we have all this information. And that's what I'm dealing with the suspicious observers and their group also. And with the Collapse Club, if you've heard of them, the Collapse Community, and even the preppers are already making change for whatever reason they want. But there's a lot of people that just like to talk, and they think the talk is action, you know, and it's not. It's just a hobby. It's just interesting, you know, and nothing's really happening. So I was saying all the different things that keep us from making change, because the cost of change is hard. Your family, your peers, people I knew that got into permaculture, started changing their lives, had to get a whole new set of friends. Right. Because they weren't interested in talking about those other things anymore. They were interested in talking about plants and growing food. You've probably seen little cartoons about that. Nobody wants to talk about plants. Yeah. But I had a conversation with a friend of mine actually in Kenya. And she was saying there that, you know, I really miss talking about community. And of course, the whole book is about community, but change in community. And if you get everybody to think the same way, how much easier it is. Well, she's in a village in Kenya, and they do live as a village, and everything is communal, and everything is, and that's their lifestyle, is living as a village. And they said, that's absolutely true. You have to where they are, you know, in order to survive. They have to grow all their food together. They have to cultivate the land together, do everything together, because this everything is so meager for resources for them. So those are the kind of responses I have from people is, this is great, but what about that? It's already at 158 pages, plus a bunch of, I have tons of appendices of information that I didn't want to put in the bulk of it. So it's interesting because each one of these chapters goes on, but what it really is doing is creating a conversation between people, and that's what I really want to happen.
Gotcha, man. You also have like two fiction, you kind of mentioned you write fiction, but you have some two specifically fictional post-collapse stories that you've been writing over the years. What kind of stories do those tell, and how do they help you think about this subject? Because I've often said, like, a lot of the, we call it prepper porn as a genre, right? Like, a lot of these collapse novels and all, they may go to the extreme, and they may not be grounded in 100% realism as to what would really happen, but they're thought experiments, and the truth is we don't know what it looks like, and by going to some level of the extreme, you can then reverse engineer preparedness for the probable.
Right.
And I think that's a good way to look at it, you know, like, not my favorite book or anything, but a classic example that goes back 30 years now is James Rawls's The Coming Collapse. I can't remember the name of the damn book. Somebody here will tell me in the live stream. But James Wesley Rawls's first book, Patriots, The Coming Collapse. That's what it was called. And yeah, it was like read like a technical manual in some ways, and it was like this extreme kind of Red Dawn scenario. But
It's
kind of like the people say they're preparing for the zombies. They don't think the freaking zombies are actually coming. What they're saying is, if you're ready for the zombie, you're ready for anything.
Right. Well, in the one of the things with the Collapse Club too, in those conversations, there are two kind of sides to all this, and one is where it's really easy, and when you're writing, you know, when you're trying to write a story, is like, first of all, kill most everybody and only leave a few left. That makes it easy because now you're going to not have so much conflict. And in our scenarios, mostly it's the fact that, well, actually, none of the people died, just all of the resources went away. Electricity went away. The satellites fell out of the sky. There's no phones. There's no communications. There's no anything. And the supply chains failed, like during COVID and things like that. So What I'm writing about more is more of the people and their daily lives as they do things. So I call them vignettes. And one of the stories about two boys and their son, their father, who was actually in the military, saw this coming. And so in their story, he sets up basically treasure hunts for them to go find supplies. So he put caches of food all around the land, miles away from their place, and hid it and used orienteering to help them get what they needed over time and learn the skills, but also didn't have put everything in one place. So he had all these little caches around, and it's about them. And these are all in Minnesota in winter, which we call the big filter. Everybody calls it that. That was the first winter, the second winter after the collapse was the big filter, because in the stories, most people go south because they think that winter is bad. I used to tell people, if everybody's going south, I'm going north. You know, it's like, that's where the fish are. That's where the lakes are. That's where wood is and warmth. And if you know how to, you know, live in wintertime. So I'm writing these stories about these two boys, their grandfather and their uncle. And it's two or three years after the collapse and their lifestyle, how they're living, how they're gathering food, and how they're basically scrounging, but also the security. The fact that there's only one radio station that's running. One of the boys has to climb up a tall tree at noon once a day with his radio just to get the news of what's going on, weather or any kind of announcements, things like that. Then there's a couple other people, two women that are solitary, living off from a community and about their lives. I don't want to give everything away, but the ingenious ways that they have learned to gather materials ahead of time, make caches ahead of time of all the resources that they're going to need, and then how they hide them. Because to be heard also is to be found. You don't shoot a gun more than once. That's one of the rules. You know, only one, make one sound, because the second sound you're going to get found. And so there's all this competition for resources going on, but also there's a community of people every once in a while that are living together. In one of the stories, we call it Ice City. And this is what happens with ice fishing houses. They just dot all over the lake. So in the wintertime, all these people move their big ice houses, the little ice houses out on the lake. That's their little city for the winter. And they protect each other and they fish and they eat and they basically have community, things like that. The other story I've been writing has actually been based on activities of a couple that live in the mountains. It gets too sketchy and they actually move to Observer Ranch. And then the story is about basically like the manual, all the different things that happen on a ranch with all these people coming in and things they have to deal with. And there are things everywhere that are going to get you. It's the small things. And even in some of the discussions I've had, and the research I've done too, what is going to get you, what's going to kill the most people, let's say in the first 2 or 3 years, and everybody, oh, it's this or it's that. Periodontal disease is the biggest killer. And I was really surprised to hear that out. Not brushing your teeth, not having good oral hygiene, that's going to kill the most people in the first 2 or 3 years because they're going to be under stress. They're not going to be able to, they're not going to have a good immune system, and any kind of decay, any kind of sore tooth is going to get abscessed. I mean, it's just those kinds of things that are really important. So it's the small things that you have to have, and also then the community of people that actually know how to do stuff. And so that's kind of the stories I'm writing about, the vignettes of individuals. They all have names. There's a group of teenagers. They're in their second winter. They're in Minnesota, living in a garage together, cobbled together a living, and they're now trying to figure out, this can't go on. They need to figure out how to join a community, but they've been outcast for so long. So it's that kind of stuff that I like to write about. And in the process, it gives me answers.
It is interesting, kind of the second, third, fourth order effects of lethality. Like, and sometimes that happens really fast. If you look at Haiti, for instance, you go back, you know, again, we're going back almost 2 decades now, but that earthquake that hit down there.
Yeah.
People
yeah.
think that all the people that died down there died because of the earthquake directly. They did not. The number one cause of death in Haiti was dehydration due to diarrhea, usually, but not always, caused by cholera.
Exactly.
Right. So exactly. Like, you destroy the ability of people to drink clean water. Sooner or later, they're going to drink the dirty water every time. There is a point at which dehydration and thirst overrides the mind's ability to go, don't drink that. And so that's just one example. Basically, the destruction of clean water and sanitation killed way more people than cinder block buildings falling on people. Because I don't know if you know this, but when you're in a place with buildings and there's an earthquake, people are not as dumb as we think they are, and they go run away from the building.
Right.
And if you're standing in an open field when there's an earthquake, unless there's a fracture opens up under you, you have a ride and then you're done and nothing really happens. Do you remember way, way back? There was a World Series game going on when there was an earthquake in California.
Yes.
And the people in the stadium just thought it was a garden variety because the stadium was so well built, nothing collapsed there. And the players were just standing around like, all right, when it's over, we'll go back to playing. And a mile away, that overpass had collapsed and killed, you know, hundreds of people.
Right.
And that's an example of, like, the thing you don't realize is what then cascades from that, like, inability to have clean water, inability to actually flush a toilet, things like that. Those become incredibly dangerous, and they're actually, for the average person, some of the least expensive and easier things to prepare for.
Right, exactly. And that's like I was saying in the writings, the water doctrine is exactly what you're saying. You have to have clean water because that's what's going to keep you healthy. You can't be drinking out of the creek. The water looks clear, all these places, but you get Giardia, you get the simplest little parasite or anything like that is going to take you down. Or if there happens to be an old uranium mine upriver that at one point breached through, you know, you have other issues like that. So it's and to kind of like with that comes along, then what's the responsibility of everybody in the group? If I have a right to clean water, then everybody else has an obligation to make sure that we have clean water, right? Just like clean air, something like that.
And let's make sure people are clear on that, because there's a hypersensitivity to entitlement now. He doesn't mean that you have to go to their house and provide it for them. He means you have to not fuck up their clean water. That's what he means. Like, being a responsible member of the community means that I don't piss in your well, is a blunt way to put it, right?
Right.
Because I think sometimes when people hear today, you know, everyone else has a responsibility to make sure, they like, that's like you're spoon feeding somebody or something. We're not talking about treating a 35-year-old like an infant. We're talking about having, like, you go into the Bible, like it's the responsibility of the guy who has the cattle to fence them in, not his neighbor's responsibility to fence them out. It's mm-hmm. that basic kind of common law principle that if what you do impacts another, then it's your responsibility.
Right. Right. Yeah. So, and actually,
go ahead.
And one that came from me too. Being in an RV for the last 5 years and living that lifestyle has brought to me the critical basis of everything that I'm doing there. I have three burners. I have my water tank. I have my gray water, my black water. And having come from permaculture and figuring out, okay, these systems were not built for me. I need to kind of retrofit this thing, you know. So the couch went out and my desk came in with my computer and my monitor, other stuff that I have, solar panels on the roof. How long can I stay in this thing? How long can I really be in here without anything coming in? And the first thing I learned was, it kind of went back to water, was I have a 40-gallon tank for water, fresh water, and I have a gray water tank and a black water tank, right? And that's because people use these for going camping, and they flush the toilet, goes in black water, and shower water goes in the gray water. Thank you for having two different tanks, first of all. But anyway, what I realized was, and I started doing that, I could have a 5-gallon water bottle with a little pump on top, the typical ones you can get, and I can fill that with reverse osmosis water pretty much anywhere, and I have two of them. That 5 gallons of drinking water would last me a week. That's all I needed for cooking, for drinking, all of that, a gallon a day. It's all it took me, a little more than a gallon a day. It's all it took me, you know, to keep. The 40 gallons was just for washing my hands, showering when I wanted to, things like that. And you could really stretch that out for a long time. Then I got a compost toilet instead of the flush toilet because I don't want to use my fresh water and then flush a toilet with it, which is one of our big issues, Colorado especially, and anywhere else. We have all this clean water and we dump it on the ground. We put it down toilets and things like that. You know, there should be a separate system for that. So I separated that out. Compost toilet. Good. Not flushing anymore. Gray water from the shower and the sink. That's the only thing that goes in the tank. And now I have twice as much room for gray water. So I went from 240s I still have 240s, but now I have 80 gallons of gray water. So I could go out in the Arizona desert for 2 weeks. Solar power, all of that. You have a generator, by the way, because sometimes you kind of want a little bit of air, right? Things like that. But that's what kind of taught me about food preparation, limited resources on that, and how to really use it efficiently. And the fact also is, because I'm living in this paper box, really, I kind of make fun of it, there's no insulation in this thing.
They suck about that.
They really do. But they do have doors, and I could, like, heat the bedroom or leave the bedroom cold during the day or whatever I want as I wanted to use it. You know, so being in an RV really helped me. And it also ties into what a lot of what I write about is that's my go-to mobility. But eventually, even in the drawdown, the RV has to turn into a stationary or it's only a vehicle to somewhere else. Yeah. You can't stay in that RV for very long. It's already more than 10 years old. Happily, it was built before COVID, if you've ever heard about those nightmares. It's sturdy, it's strong, and I take care of it. And I'm actually learning how to protect it from UV, from the weather. I mean, it's funny. I went from, you know, to just setting it down to now anchoring it to the ground with ground anchors because of storms. And then also I have foil netting over the top of it because I'm in the desert a lot and in hot climates, and I shield the whole thing with foil netting. So there's a lot of things I've learned about it almost as a organism. And how I need to protect it as it protects me.
Yeah, the big hack down here for long-term RV living where you put it in one place and stay is people build or facilities actually charge a premium for this, kind of like a pole barn structure where you're under a canopy, because our biggest thing is the sun, right? Like, yes, it gets cold here, but I actually think it's easier to survive cold climates than warm because there's tons of shit you can burn and heat is easy to produce and you can put more clothes on, but you can only get so naked before they arrest you and take you to jail as a lunatic, right? Like, so, you know, you can only do so much to cool off, but there's lots you can do to warm up. But I'll tell you the other thing, though, is my next question for you, so you can add to what you just said if you want to, because you hit it pretty good, was, you know, what do you personally do to be prepared? But from your answer there, I would also say that the two groups of people that I've had on the air here, and sometimes it's not even about preparedness. It's about some component of what they're doing, but it always comes into preparedness, RVers and people that spend a lot of time on boats. And I'm not talking about like a bass boat. I'm talking about people that have like, you know, a true cabin cruiser type situation where they live on a boat long term. Both of those, by the very nature of what they are, require a preparedness mindset. And I guess the other one would be anybody that's off grid. And, you know, when you say, well, how far is town? And they say about an hour. All three of those cohorts are always preppers, even if they don't think they are.
Right. And there's a lot of people I've met that they have the mindset. They don't think they're a prepper. But again, it's lifestyle. You know, mm-hmm. it's the choices that they're making that kind of separate them from being dependent on things that might go away. Yeah. And I know there's like even a group of people, the preppers that are sailboats. That is their escape from like the West Coast and other areas. They're basically building out sailboats because they're just going to hit the ocean. Being in the center of the continent, I don't know a lot about how that works, but you know, I would think that pretty cool if there aren't too many pirates, fishing and living out on the water.
Yeah. And you know, most of those guys, they have little motors on those boats too. So if you're going to use sail as your primary propulsion and you keep your fuel tank topped off, man, you got range. You got range right there. You know, like you can go somewhere where there's less. That's the other thing too. Like, I think this viewpoint that everything will collapse everywhere at the same time is very short-sighted. I really do. It's just never how society, like they always say history doesn't repeat, but it often rhymes. I'm going to say it almost always rhymes. And there has never been a time where everything collapsed everywhere at the same time. The closest we've had was manufactured. And it was just a few years ago. We all know what I'm talking about. Right? I don't want to go too deep into that because they're still freaking banning channels and shit. I've been to YouTube prison so many times. I should have tattoos from it by now. But yeah, I mean, like that. The only thing I've ever seen like globally shut down society has been a coordinated edict by government. So there's inevitably going to be places, even if everything's bad, where things are worse. Things are middle and things are better. And mobility, I think, is a big part of that. Is there any other way that like living in a motorhome has influenced your, like not just your preparedness, but your design choices and things like that?
It really has. Mostly it's so you can imagine I went from a very large log home and a farm to basically 200 square feet and getting rid of stuff. And I was getting rid of stuff. It's almost like I was on a wagon train, you know, after a while. I was like, okay, this has got to go. My favorite blender, you know, all these things that I had, you know, had to go. So minimalism is really what got to me. What do I need to have? And then when you get something, it has to work and it has to be really good. It's not just on sale. And this comes from my background also is backpacking. I was a Boy Scout leader, I was in the Boy Scouts, all that kind of stuff, canoe trips in Canada for 9 days, things like that. So I had the backpacking camp background, you know, going out for 9 days with a 25 pound pack. Ray Jardine, who invented Friends, they're the little cams you use for rock climbing, which I was in when I was much younger. He wrote a book called Beyond Backpacking. It's an excellent book, and it's about decisions based on fear, which is one of the things I write about also. People go to REI and all these places, Shields or wherever, and they buy all this camping gear just in case. And they end up having an 80-pound pack carrying all this crap that they're supposed to enjoy, you know, when they're out backpacking. So it's that background and the minimalism that I learned from that book, and things that have multiple functions are the best, right? So you buy really good things that last. You kind of have redundant systems. Even with Ray Jardine, you know, wet rain gear and things like that, it was so funny. He says, bring an umbrella. You don't need rain gear, you know. It's like, just bring an umbrella and keep dry. And also, that's shade when it's really hot. I mean, it's so funny. We're out backpacking in the mountains with an umbrella, which is a pretty cool sight, I'm sure, for people. But the RV really brought me to that, is like, take care of what you have. And this has happened, too, with a lot of people I've worked with at Homestead Design. They want to do all these great things. And I'm looking at their house and their roof and their siding and their driveway and all these things. I said, you know what? Maintenance first. You got to take care of what you have before you start going off on all these other things. because that's what's going to get you in the long run. And it's like I said about having a toothbrush and, you know, oral hygiene. It's the little things that are going to get you, that are going to break down, and now you got nothing, right? Microbes, whatever they might be, like you said, cholera, little organisms, yeah, things like that.
Yeah. Even during COVID, putting aside what I said about the manufactured shutdown of society, you know, some people did get really sick and some people did die. And there was a direct correlation. If we take out, I personally think, and I'm not putting anybody down for their age, but like there's got to be an age where we just say if you die after that age, you die because you're old. Like, because sooner or later, that's going to happen. I don't know if it's 85, 88, whatever it is, but there's a point, like, you know, when you hear somebody passed away and you didn't really know them, you kind of knew of them, and you're like, well, how old was they? And when they say, like, well, he was 67, you're like, oh, man. When they say, like, he was 98, you're like, well, I mean, right? Yeah. But if you go into the younger groups and people that weren't even, they didn't necessarily look sick, when you looked under the hood, like, those people had vitamin D levels that were almost non-existent, would be one example. Or they had extreme nutrient deficiencies, like specifically a deficiency in something that's super cheap and widely available, like zinc, right? And mm-hmm. selenium, right? Like, there was some underlying serious health issue. So the person who's healthier is more likely to be resilient in these situations than the one who's not. And a lot of things that happen to us that affect our health, there maybe isn't a lot we can do about it, but most of it we can. And I think that's why it is so important that we address that, because to think about, you got taken out by an advanced cold because you had a zinc deficiency. I mean, that's a really tough pill to swallow, and you could have swallowed a little easy pill and it wouldn't have happened. I mean, like, that's something I think we need to be thinking about, it because there's the whole debate about terrain theory and germ theory. And I think, you know, turning that into a binary one-off is dumb. I think that there are diseases, there are illnesses, there are pathogenic bacteria, right? These things do happen. And there's also the reality of the terrain. And I think those two things go together. Everybody uses a fish tank to describe it, and I only assume those people never had fish tanks, because I've had fish tanks. And what they say is, you know, one guy puts antibiotics in the tank, and the other guy cleans the tank or whatever. Well, depending on what the fish have, I'm probably doing both.
Right.
Right. Because there is, like, if I have a bacterial infection, okay, you know, or if I have something like with fish, ick is a parasitic infection, I'm going to raise the temperature. I'm going to salinate the water and I'm going to clean the tank. Right? I'm going to do all of those things. I'm going to address the terrain and I'm going to go after the pathogen or the invader or the parasite. And I think that people need to be thinking that way going forward, because if you don't have a strong health foundation, some of these things that wouldn't take you out, that would just make you sick, might take you much further. Or, you know, I remember, you know, I go back long enough, I remember little kids that had braces and shit from polio, right? That were contemporaries of mine, maybe just a couple years older than me, because I was right at that kind of point where that shifted off. And so sometimes illnesses that don't kill you do reduce your ability long term to function. Yeah. And in a collapse scenario, the last thing you want to be is dead weight on somebody else when you thought you were going to be the guy that was going to be helping other people.
It's you know, and that's, I mean, you could see the gray coming in here. Yeah. The joints are a little bit sore. Yeah. I'm not running and I'm not jumping all, or like I used to, you know, things like that. But you hope that you're bringing some wisdom and experience to the scene. Right. And I think that's what's important, is, you know, all those things that slow you down also bring experience, you know, for you to that you can bring to other people with that. So, and part of it too is maybe just taking a little more time to make decisions. And I think also not get rattled by things so much. And like you're saying about preconditions for, you know, physically, there's also mental preconditions, right? About stress and the ability to manage these things, or just the fact that, you know, somebody going off the cliff because I can't get Starbucks every morning, you know, I mean, my life is ruined, you know, where is my latte, you know, something like that. It's like, you have to be sturdy. But I think also that comes with, if I might say, through experience, stress yourself now so that later it's not that big a deal. I used to do ice rescues with the Boy Scouts. I put on my wetsuit and go into a frozen lake and a hole in the ice, right? But we used to also swim in Lake Superior. Cold water isn't that big a shock for some of us as other people. So you jump in, you know, the first time, yeah, third or fourth time, I know what's coming. Guess what? I'm not as shocked, and it's not reflecting in my body that much either.
Yeah, man. Let's take a few questions. I only got like two questions came in here. Sure. I'm going to tell everybody who they come from. One comes from Mongrel Future, and the other from Justice Kelly. If you did not hear your name, you are still here. You have a question or something for us to comment on. You are now at like what we used to call last call for alcohol. You have last call for questions. And if you don't ask it by the time we're done with these two, you will not get an answer. I'm only going to hold my guess so long. So Mongrel Future says, since you mentioned the 08 financial crisis, I saw this morning someone reviewing one of those trade trackers, noting that a lot of well-returning politicians are selling out. Thoughts. So basically saying some big-time politicians that always have the inside track are selling off their holdings, people with large gains. That doesn't surprise me at all.
Yeah. Those are the patterns. You know, permaculture is big into patterns, and that pattern recognition, right? And I also a lot of times call it the sniff test. You see these things going on, and the first time you see it, you note it. The second or third time, but now if there's a pattern, now we need to start paying attention. You know, it's like power shutoffs or resources limited somewhere area, or something's not happening, or, you know, the Strait of Hormuz and everything that's going on with the price of gas, things like that. Those are all patterns and signals for us. So if that's happening, you kind of have to go, okay, let's distill that down. What does that mean? What do those people know? Why are they doing that? Right. And the hard part is you need an insider probably to tell you, or it's like I do say this, and in all the things we're talking about, you have to decide on who you trust and who you're going to believe on certain things. So when it comes to like space weather and the science of all that, Ben Davidson, the ranch, absolutely. I just love his science and what he says, things like that. When it comes to canning, or if it comes to somebody who knows how to farm, I know people that are really good at growing crops and vegetables, you know, in arid climates. So you kind of trust, you believe. When it comes to something like that, like with the markets, that's kind of tough for me because I kind of got out of it. I don't really have much in there. I get my income and my assets other ways. But there's probably somebody that could tell you that. And I'm sure there's a lot of pundits and political people that are probably already looking at that and going to have you an answer. It's like, well, what does that mean? What are our thoughts about that? I know that there's even a service now that can invest for you based on what the senators and congressmen are buying too, from what I understand.
Yeah. There's literally a website called Pelosi Tracker. Yeah. And it's Nancy Pelosi's holdings, when she sells, and they literally sell a subscription to the deeper data so that you know, you're not doing it after the fact. You're kind of real time tracking what Paul and Nancy Pelosi are doing with their money. I'm not a political person. I don't believe in voting harder is going to change things. I've been around long enough. I've seen every makeup and mix of federal government you can come up with. Three, you know, holding the House, the Senate, and the presidency. I've seen it split. I've seen it split and split. Like there is, and I've seen it by both sides. And I've seen no real difference in the bullshit they pull. The one constant is they always seem to know what to buy and what to sell. And I personally think there's two things that if this government was going to be of any use to anybody that need to be in place that I don't think ever will. Well, three. One would be term limits. Two would be an absolute ban on trading stocks and companies and commodities. Like you don't get to do that while you're in government. You know, you can give your money to somebody and they can do it for you, but you don't get to participate in it. You got to have those two things in place to get anywhere and the last one would be that when you make a law, you don't get to say it doesn't apply to you. Those would be the three things that would actually improve government, which is why they will never happen. But moving on from there, let's talk about what Justice Kelly has to say. Who do the clients hire to do the actual construction segments, infrastructure, site work, building systems like foundation, carpenter, utilities? I guess you're talking about your clients when you do a design consultation and you say, put this building here or whatever. And I think that would be whoever's available to do it if they don't do it themselves, because when you tell a contractor what you want done, they generally, if you act as a good general yourself, your subcontractor does what they tell you to.
Right.
Or you tell them to, I'm sorry.
Sure. Well, we do, you know, United Designers and our designers, we're known for our maps and our organization, and they're well and easily read is what we say, you know, how they're done. So, and that's how I work too. I design for people. We give them the backup documentation, the support information, all of that, the phases of installation, those kinds of things. And I haven't done installs for many, many years. I just don't have the time, and that's not what I want to do. I want to keep doing design and learning, traveling, doing design work. So we say, it's like, if we're going to dig a pond, find the local guy that knows the land, right? If I'm going to dig a well, get the well guy. You know, there's a local guy. All you have to do is talk to people. And at one time I got a call and somebody said, you know, I want to, you know, put a garden in my backyard. What should I do? And I would say, walk around the neighborhood and just see what everybody else is doing first, you know, get to know people and what's going on. So, and it's great to have discussions as I've traveled with, you know, this guy he brings out his backhoe and he's testing the ground and whatever, because they're going to basically dig a small lake on this property in Georgia. And then he's just telling us about the last 30 years, what's been happening to the water table. It's been going down, the soil, this and that. So much information from the local people. And so you hire the locals to do it.
Now,
when it comes to carpentry, electric, we always say it has to be done really well, right? And so, again, you're going to have to do your homework and find those people, word of mouth, who is good, who can you trust. And then that's for me, because I'm an outsider everywhere I go. I don't know who those people are. If it's anything on the land, I got construction people for doing earthworks and things like that. Let's fly in Eric. Let's fly in Brian. You know, they'll do it, because all I have to do to Eric is I just grunt and he knows. You know, he's been there.
And that's nice when you have that. But I've worked with quite a few heavy equipment operators, and you say something like, you know what a swale is, and they always say yes. And you explain it, and they still say yes. And then when you get them to start doing it, they don't know.
Right.
And you have to explain exactly what you're looking for. But what I found with those guys, a guy that's good with an excavator, for instance, it'll take him just a couple minutes to understand what you're actually asking him to do. Yeah. And once he does, he kind of grooves on it, because he's actually getting to be creative instead of just moving shit flat, right?
Yeah.
Like, or just making a ditch, right? Well, this ditch is on contour, and it needs to be, you know, 9 feet wide. So I remember before the first guy had to do this, he couldn't grok what I was saying about when to pull up and how to keep the back cut. So we got line marking paint, and we marked the front of the swale and the back of the swale. And once he did it and he got the throw of the arm right and understood what he was doing, and you know, he's just kind of running those tracks sideways. And excavators are great compared to like a backhoe, because you're just kind of tracking along and resetting, and you just blow through it. He did the other two in that system like he was blindfolded in a savant, like Tommy in the Pinball Wizard movie, you know? He just had to. So my point of bringing that up is not just with earthworks. It's any of these things. If you pay someone like Daniel here, or like Nick Ferguson from the Expert Counsel, or someone to come and counsel or consult, and they leave you with this great plan, and then you bring a contractor to do something, and be sure you understand from your consultant what you want, and then be sure your contractor understands what you want. And even if you're sure they do, you need to be there looking when ground is broke or when frames are going up and things like that. And you need to catch it early, because what will happen as a contractor, when you catch it early and say, this is what I meant, oh, okay, I'll do it. When they get way ahead of you, they don't ever want to back up and correct things, right? So I think that's good with anything, even home, like remodeling a kitchen, be there. But with this kind of work, you are 4 hours of looking the other direction away from a type one error. Right. It's about 4 hours between when you turned your head and looked back to where, oh, shit, why did we do this? Right. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that answered, you know, everybody's questions got answered that had. I didn't see any more come in. So do you want to tell people how they can learn more about you, your work, things like that? And I do have, like, all the resources you sent me will be in the show notes, but go ahead and mention them.
So Southwoods ecosystems.com is my website. And that's where my personal design work is. UnitedDesigners.org is our cooperative of designers. And that's where we have training courses, resources for the designers. We all, a little bit about United Designers, we work as a cooperative and we share everything. We have a Dropbox, all of our designs, all of our resources. We work on Adobe Illustrator. We also work with the Natural Capital Plant database, which is now part of United Designers. 4,500 plants on that now. It's a great, great thing to look at. $30 or $50 a year, depending upon the output that you want. Natural permacultureplantdata.com is that site. But with United Designers, we work together, we design together, and we hire each other. And that's the biggest thing. And that's what's kind of like, we're back to like working as a community, because some of us, of course, know something more than other people about where we're working. So if I'm working up in the Northwest, or I'm working with fire, you know, I'm working with Neo Botrando. You know, Eric Berg, who I kind of mentioned earlier, he's helping me with Earthworks. He's worked with all sorts of people, Mark Shepard and everybody else, travels the country doing that, right? So we kind of work as teams. We have designers in Belgium, the Netherlands, and Spain, Costa Rica, Canada, of course, all over the U.S. And we work together as teams, and we ask each other questions. And every Thursday at 9 a.m. Central, we have a 90-minute chat where people show up, we show our designs, we talk about stuff. We might talk about baseball and sci-fi, too. Sci-fi kind of takes over once in a while. But we show our designs and ask questions, and then we might have Odd from Kenya showing videos of her earthworks that she's doing there and some of the problems they're having with when it rains during the monsoon seasons, things like that. So uniteddesigners.org is the big organization. Southwoodsecosystems.com is my website. I'm sure you'll have on here my email address, permaculturehalsey@gmail.com. But still doing design, still traveling, loving it in Colorado, meeting a lot of good people here, and just working the system the best I can. I'm available all the time for questions about different things, but what I'm really trying to do, and that's what United Designers do, is take people that learn permaculture and want to go to the next level professionally or do things really well. Or it's kind of like Jack was saying, if you're going to have somebody come to your place and start doing this work for you, you kind of have to know a little bit more about it than they do.
Right? They do.
Yeah, you really have to be in it. And I've had people also that, you know, I'll do a design for them and they say, can you do another one? What it'll look like in 5 years? And it's like, well, in 5 years, you should be the expert, I hope. You know, you don't need me anymore, you know. So, but doing design and traveling is my favorite. And I have to say, too, if you've seen some of the things in Maui or Molokai with the rains they've had there, like 48 inches of rain and 24 hours, just amazing. There are permaculture work that we've done there now that is showing its face, and we're getting now working with developers. So that's kind of been my goal, like my whole career, is to get into, you know, 600-acre developments, working with developers and housing and things like that, making those big pattern decisions for them, too. So that's where I'm at. That's what we're about. And those are the resources that I provide.
Well, hey, Daniel, I appreciate you being with us today. It's been a great discussion. Thank you for being here with us and giving us your time.
Thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity.
All right, folks, real quick, that was a great interview. Hope you guys enjoyed it. We will, of course, have no live stream tomorrow because it will be an expert council Q&A show for the week tomorrow, and that just doesn't happen in video, so you'll have to tune in on audio only, and that'll round out our week. So I will, in advance, wish you guys all a very productive and happy weekend. I also want to go ahead and wrap up and let you guys know a way you can support the show, and that is doing your online shopping starting at tspaz.com. That's T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. If you start your shopping there, you help us out no matter what you buy. I've been kind of running the same item all week, and that's just because it's such a great dadgone tool set. This is made by a company called Eastly, which I'm sure is some sort of a Chinese chop shop or something. But dadgone, if they do not make some of the best quality tools I've seen at that price point, period. I would put this set, which sells for $57, $58, If I looked at it and you said, well, what would you expect to pay for this, you know, with just a different brand name on it? $120, $130. It's that level of quality. The milling, the finish on the tools. Again, I've been using these for about 2 years. And I found them originally because I wanted to make sure that I had a socket set and like a basic hand tool set in every vehicle I own. And I'm not going to go out and buy the quality of tools that I keep in my, you know, my workshop or something like that, to throw in the trunk of a car when I might not ever really need to use it. But I wanted something that I could rely on if I had to. So I did a bunch of research. I found this company. I found the reviews. The reviews were good. An analysis of the reviews using a tool told me they weren't fake. That's nice to know with these types of companies. And I gave them a shot. And I've been completely impressed by this set and basically a few other things I bought from them. So this is something you can add to your tool set that you can know you can rely on. You know you're going to get good quality. And by going up to an impact quality tool, meaning designed to be used on like a pneumatic gun, you right there, you kind of make a jump in quality with your tool sets. That's a little hack you can use when you're ever you're evaluating different classes of tools to pick up. But everybody should have basic hand tools. I'm a big fan of power tools. I bleed black and yellow. I'm a DeWalt guy, but I'm also a big fan of tools that work even when the power doesn't work, the tools that work anywhere, tools that don't rely on a battery or an electrical plug. And I think that, you know, not only should you have tools, you'd have a basic mechanical and repair knowledge, home improvement knowledge to use them. And this would be a good set. And if you're looking to pick a setup for somebody as a gift or something, but you don't want to be going to the Snap-on van or some shit like that and spending thousands of dollars, it's a great option. Remember, whether you buy that or anything, if you like this show, you want to support us, like super no out-of-pocket way to do that is just do your online shopping starting at tspaz.com. T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. Start your shopping there. No matter what you buy, you'll help us out. You can buy stuff there from Vavor. You can buy stuff there from Amazon, and it's a real easy thing to do. Also, consider becoming a member of the Member Support Brigade. If you do that, the discounts you'll get in my membership program will more than pay for your membership. I just used my own membership program for a discount on one order from one company in there, and I saved $84. And the membership is $50 a year to become an MSB member. So go to survivalpodcast.com/members to learn more about that. And with that, I will say goodbye to you. Remember, if you want to get in touch with Daniel or learn more about his work, possibly get in touch with him about consulting, anything like that, I have his two websites that he mentioned, plus his Facebook and LinkedIn profiles and profiles on Facebook for the two entities as well that will be in the audio show notes. If you're watching this on video, right down there in the video notes, there is a link. It's kind of one of the first links in there that will take you over to the audio side with all those additional resources. I don't put them in the video notes because YouTube's a bitch about it if you put too many links and they don't let it work. So I just kind of put them all on the audio side of things for you. And if you're watching me live right now and you click that link right now this minute, It'll go to a page not found because we're not quite done yet. About 30 minutes after the live ends, that episode will go up on the audio side, hit all the audio distribution platforms and stuff like that. Again, thank you guys for tuning in today. Have a great day and have a very productive weekend.
They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.